If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
During this difficult time, we want to make it as easy as possible for our readers to get their copy of BBC History Magazine or BBC History Revealed. So for the next few months, we'll deliver your favourite magazine direct to your door with no delivery charge. From today, you can save up to 70% off the shop price and subscribe from just £9.99. That's just £1.66 per issue. There's never been a better time to get your favourite history magazine delivered direct to your home. To take advantage of this unmissable offer, please visit buysubscriptions.com/History Extra and choose your magazine. Don't forget, all of our magazines are also available digitally on your mobile or tablet device. Visit buysubscriptions.com/History Extra for more information. We look forward to welcoming you. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. On today's podcast, we have a conversation with the historian Emily Brand, whose latest book, The Fall of the House of Byron, follows the fates of the Romantic poet Lord Byron's ancestors over three generations, exploring a Georgian family tale of shipwrecks, murder, and sex scandals. Our deputy digital editor, Eleanor Evans, spoke with Emily down the line to find out more.
So thanks so much, Emily, for joining us on the History Extra podcast.
No, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Great. So many of our listeners will be familiar with Lord Byron, the sixth Lord Byron, I should say. His reputation, very famously, being mad, bad and dangerous to know. But your new book shows there's a longer history of Byron's behaving badly. And is it fair to say that the apple didn't fall far from that tree?
I think that does tend to be, it sounds like an obvious conclusion, but I do think to an extent that is true. As you say, the sixth Lord George, the sixth Lord Byron, will be the one that people most associate with that name. And he inherits in 1798 and obviously goes on to forge this successful and notorious career, both in poetry and in just generally outraging society, you know, with all his exploits. But there's been so much written about him, both he and his ancestors, they become sort of veiled in this myth created in his lifetime, especially after his death in the sort of early 19th century. So what I wanted to do with my book is look back a couple of generations. It's not sort of a thousand-year history of them, specifically to look back to the poet's grandfather's generation, and it follows this man, John Byron, and his two elder siblings from birth in the 1720s to almost the very end of the century when the poet inherits. So it's basically a prequel, really, if we'll be sort of Netflix series blockbuster about it. But it's sort of a group biography, really, of three Byron siblings, and it just follows them through wars and sex scandals. You know, there's a shipwreck and a murder trial thrown in there as well. So it's all about the drama, as the poet was himself. So I think certainly in that way, he inherited their sort of tendency for notoriety. But he took it one further, actually. I'll give him credit for that.
So what was your way into this book? Was it Byron himself, or was it another way in?
Well, a lot of my research in the past has been about the history of love and sex and seduction and all of this during the long 18th century. So while I've been researching other things, obviously the poet has just been constantly intruding, basically, on what I'm trying to do. He wouldn't leave me alone. So he's always been lurking in the back of my mind, really. But actually, separately, what drew me into this family group specifically was Isabella, actually, who's the eldest sister of this group of siblings. And I found a portrait of her by Thomas Gainsborough, and I just fell in love with it immediately. You know, when you just see something, you're just enchanted. And so I started digging around trying to find out who this woman was, and it turned out she was born a Byron. She became a countess, and in digging further about her family, I then was learning about the stories of her two brothers, one of whom was this so-called wicked Lord Byron and is sort of your archetypal villain, according to tradition. And then the younger brother, John, who was the poet's grandfather, who was sort of presented as this gallant hero, serving king and country. And the more I learned about different characters, I just thought these all have to be these stories brought together and told as a family history, really, because it's so gripping, and I hope that I've done justice to their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, as you said, there's so much kind of scandal in the book to keep everyone entertained. And I wonder if we could just pick up on a few of those tales in a bit more detail. But perhaps we maybe start with Isabella, who you just mentioned was your kind of way in. What was her kind of route?
Well, I love Isabella. Obviously, I started with her, but I think as a personality as well, she's my favourite of the siblings. I unearthed quite a lot of her unpublished correspondence, and her voice and her spirit just really sparkles through in these letters. She was the oldest sibling. She was born in 1791, and she was the only daughter as well. But she was a really vivacious character. She loved writing poetry. She was a really talented singer. But then she was super interested in cooking and medicine and all this practical sort of almost scientific side of things as well. But she didn't care at all for rank, you know, or she hated ceremony and all these sorts of trappings of being an aristocrat, even when she married to become a countess. And her sort of driving force, though, for her personality was that she was entirely led by her heart, and she just spent her whole life just desperate to find true love, really. And she was rattling across the country and then rattling across Europe, getting herself into all sorts of trouble, looking for men, basically, who had sort of previously said they were in love with her. And she was just got very caught up in that. And I think that informed a lot of her adventures. But so she runs through, she marries, first of all, actually quite sensibly. She does what her mum tells her. She marries the Earl of Carlisle, which is obviously very good for injecting a bit of respectability and cash into the family. But she has her second husband, who she marries almost immediately after being widowed. And he's far below her rank. He's 13 years younger than she is, very unsuitable. So they have this secret engagement. And she sort of marries quickly before anyone can dispute it. Following this marriage, she's just then totally charmed by another young baronet. She follows him off to Europe. That doesn't work out. And then she finds a German soldier who just totally charms her, and they tour Europe together for, I think, approaching 15 years, just trying and failing to pass him off as a German baron. So she's just totally led by this romantic spirit. I suppose I was just totally caught up in that. I loved it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know it's not necessarily, it's definitely not a new revelation to say people had lots of children in the past, but reading her story, I was really struck by, you know, was it 5 children by the age of 28 she had?
Yes, yes. She was doing her dynastic duty there for sure. And I think it's after she has a son finally. I think he's the 4th child. She has a son, so she's done her duty there. And then her first husband, who's much, much older than she is, he dies. So it's really, there are all these stories of how after she was a widow, then she really came into her own to follow this sort of pleasure-filled lifestyle. So, yeah.
Can we talk a bit then? Because obviously her behaviour did attract comment at the time. But how reflective was her story of kind of, you know, attitudes or pleasures of the day? Or was she kind of out on her own a bit?
I think certainly she was she was chastised for this behaviour, not least by her son back home. She's, you know, she's travelling around Europe with this con man German soldier, essentially, as they can see it, into her 50s and 60s. So she's sort of gallivanting off living this life. Her family, her children at home, and their friends and their sort of political allies are all desperately writing to her saying, you know, you need to come back, you need to leave this man and come back and we'll look after you. But she just wouldn't, because she was happy with him, with the life she was living. So, yes, I mean, the amazing thing about Isabella is that when she eventually does come back to England and this man is sort of scared off almost, the icing on the cake really is that when she finally comes back, she's dragged back in semi-disgrace. She writes and publishes an etiquette guide for young, soon-to-be married women, which is such a bold move, considering that it didn't tally up with her own behaviour for any of her life. I don't know if she was a bit deluded or it's just a, you know, tenacity on her part, but it was a successful etiquette guide. But as letters of the time of people who were buying it have shown, it was quite a lot that they knew her reputation, and sort of it was quite a joke that she was presuming then to tell young women how best to live their lives and how to be a faithful wife. So I think, you know, it was a time there were affairs, as sort of divorce court records show and the gossip, newspaper gossip will show, but I think she was just so brazen about her intent to follow life as she wished. I do think she stands out a bit, actually.
Mm-hmm. And she obviously had plenty of kind of personal tribulations inside her own family as well to deal with. You already mentioned the villainy of her elder brother William and John's story as well. I wondered if we could pick up on his story, because it really is a really remarkable one.
It really is. I think that John's story is probably the one that most people will find the most sort of thrilling. So he would become the poet's grandfather, John Byron. He was the 3rd child, so Isabella's younger brother. He was born in 1723, and, you know, he was the 2nd son. So they're stereotypically destined for the military. This is what he does. So he goes into the Navy at 13, and he's launched into this amazing career almost immediately. On his second voyage, his ship is shipwrecked, and there's this subsequent survival story of him sort of making his way through life in this unfamiliar coast of South America and trying to make their way back up to through Chile and back to England. But this takes the best part of 5.5 years, and everything that can go wrong goes wrong. They're facing starvation, they're facing obviously hostilities from indigenous peoples, and he's bitten by a spider, a poisonous spider, and, you know, this just everything that could happen does. And he publishes a narrative, his own account of this story, when he's much older, and it's immediately a sensation, and it's immediately picked out as the most harrowing story of the entire century, rivaling any of the fiction that was coming out in that time as well. And this is just the beginning of his career. I think it is probably the most remarkable episode. But then he goes on, gets a very distinguished career in the Navy through wars, and undertaking voyages of exploration as well. He directly paves the way for the voyages of Captain Cook. And it's also John who claims the Falklands for Britain as well in 1765. So he sort of kicks off that whole controversy as well. So it's this career, and it goes right through to the American Revolution, where a number of future presidents are sort of keeping an eye on him and willing him to fail. So it's just fantastic, really. He's, as I say, very much seen as the gallant military hero of the family. He's achieving glory for Britain. But then he's coming to the rescue of his family members when they need bailing out as well, which is basically all the time. So he's quite this beleaguered, reliable family character. I mean, in historical terms, he's gone down in history as Foul Weather Jack Byron. This is the nickname that he sort of gets as part of the Byronic family myths. And he gets this nickname during the American Revolutionary Wars because he's so constantly pursued and thwarted by storms at every turn. So, I mean, when reading the book, I think that I can give hints that he's obviously not a hero to everybody. Obviously not the people he's at war with, and certainly not to his poor, long-suffering wife as well. The reality is more complicated, but he does have a truly gripping life story, certainly.
Mm-hmm. And can we say a little more about his own personal life was commented on in the sources of the day?
Definitely. I mean, he was very much a liked figure, actually, and when he came back from this shipwreck adventure, he gained a lot of respect from his colleagues at the Admiralty for this because of his behaviour. Part of the story is that there is after the shipwreck, there is a mutiny, and the vast part of the crew basically mutiny against the captain and take the little longboat that they've been building and sail off, leaving the captain to die, basically. And John is one of the few people who stays behind, stays loyal to the captain and sort of doesn't necessarily agree with his plan, but, you know, he's doing his duty sort of thing. So by the time they make it back to England, this is very well looked on professionally as a sort of gallant, handsome young man who's endured all of this and come back quite chipper and ready to get married and then go straight back off to war again, obviously serves him very well in the press. And this reputation that he makes for himself by his early 20s sort of continues. He's really well respected. He achieves some feats in battle during the Seven Years' War that really help his reputation. And, even when he sort of gets involved in his own little personal sex scandal, when it is reported, it's reported with sort of winks and, well, you know, he is a one kind of, his wife's always pregnant and such a good adventurer as well. So I think even then, the public was quite inclined to look kindly on him, and his reputation at the time and after has always been of a very gallant and noble military man, but he was just super unfortunate with the way storms follow him about and sort of thwarted his attempts to serve the country.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And so he's hiding out at his sister's house in France and he's writing her these letters, and they are hugely sexually charged, I'll say, and I think it's quite difficult on reading them not to conclude that they were having an incestuous sexual relationship.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So if that's one Jack, we've also got another Jack in this account, Mad Jack Byron, who was the son of John and, as you say, long-suffering Sophia. His was a quite a different tale.
Yes, well, I think in tracing the tales, I think Jack, who was the poet's father, his story really takes a lot more from that of his uncle William, who was the wicked lord. So these two characters are very much presented as villains. They're terrible with money, very into gambling, very into womanizing and affairs, with a bit of sort of bad temper and violence thrown in. I think part of that must be due to the fact that they were both the eldest sons and heirs. You know, they're brought up to feel like they are the important, most important one of the family brood. So yeah, he's the eldest son of John, although I think he's the fourth or fifth child, but he's born 1757 is the first record of his existence, and he sort of, records are quite patchy for his early life, but he's supposed to have gone to a military school in London, and there's some evidence that he might have he joined the army fairly young, and then that he might have been sent over to Antigua to get sort of involved in sort of issues that are going on out there. But the first one of the earliest records that we have for him is one of the first scandals that he's embroiled in, and a major scandal for the family in general, which is his affair at the age, I think he's about 24, with a married lady, Carmarthen. And he falls into this affair. She's slightly older. She's got a few children. And she falls pregnant very quickly. And she seems to have no qualms about, once this sort of news is out, about saying to her husband, you know, I've been having this affair with this soldier and I'm pregnant and it's not yours. So this couple are able to essentially elope together. They go off down to the south coast and try and hide to escape this her husband's fury. And essentially, the husband is forced to file for divorce, and she seems very keen to stick with Jack as well. So it does seem that at least on her side, it was a love match. But this because it then goes to the divorce courts, everything becomes very public accounts of the case, which includes all these amazing details about how they've been caught in bed together and Jack's been sort of half naked snoring in Lady Carmarthen's bed, and all of these great details is not only read aloud in the court, but then made into sort of transcribed and printed and published as well. And people were desperate to get their hands on these. So his sort of main introduction into society is this scandal. And some take to him semi-kindly, in that the blame falls on Amelia, on the errant wife, more than him. Others are absolutely disgusted by him, and they say he's a terrible, awkward, stupid fellow who just couldn't help boasting about his conquest. So, it's a bit of a mixed bag, really, his first public reputation. But from this point, really, because of his behaviour with spending and with sexual escapades, his reputation only gets worse. But actually, you know, this is mostly in terms of what's on the public record, I suppose. I'm talking about what reputation he's built up. But one of the most fascinating batches of source material that I came across in researching was quite a large stash of letters from Jack to his elder sister, Fanny Lee, who was married. They'd been living together briefly at her house in France, and this is at this point Jack's in his mid-30s. He's had a second wife. They've had a son together who is the young future poet. He has abandoned them. Little George, his son, is about 2.5, 3. And so he's hiding out at his sister's house in France, and he's writing her these letters, and they are hugely sexually charged, I'll say. And I think it's quite difficult on reading them not to conclude that they were having an incestuous sexual relationship. So it was quite grim reading, some of it. He's a very unusual character, super sort of very entitled, very, very arrogant. The letters are filled with news of his sort of sexual escapades and the acts he likes to do and with what sort of woman. And essentially, on having read them, it's quite clear that he's trying to make his sister jealous, essentially, because it's also full of these other phrases about how she's the most beautiful woman he's ever seen, and that when he's having sex, he's thinking of her face, essentially. So, it's unusual. And it's sort of difficult to then not make comparisons with the poet's life and his own incestuous affair with his half-sister Augusta, who was Jack's other child. So of Jack's two surviving children, they both fell into this sexual relationship with each other as well. So it's quite a tangled web there. It doesn't help with the family tree. It's a lot of cousins marrying and also siblings having sex with each other. So
I was going to ask about the cousins, actually, because that seems to be a bit more common in this period, even first cousins marrying. So what more broadly was kind of the societal norm in the 18th century where you're writing about?
Yeah, first cousins at this point, totally fine. obviously, the poet's grandparents, so that's John Fowler, the Jack Byron, and his cousin Sophia. They were first cousins. Their mothers were sisters, and this seems to have been, there's not any sign that they were especially marked out for each other. But as soon as he gets back from his adventures in South America, he is reunited with this cousin who is 17 all of a sudden, and they were by all accounts very fond of each other, and that would have been totally fine. In cases where the financial status wasn't quite as even, it would be different, I would say. With John and Sophia, they were of equal sort of standing. She was very beautiful, he had a great reputation. Financially, they were sort of even, so it was fine. But there is a later instance of cousin marriage, a generation later, where William's son, William Jr., I'll call him, is sort of set up with this intended bride who has a fortune. But just on the eve of the wedding, he elopes with his cousin Juliana, who is John's daughter, who has really not much money to her name at all. And this causes a sensation and a scandal among the family. But this is because William Jr. has thrown away the fortune. It's not because they're cousins. So I would say that marriage with cousins was quite normal for the time. It wouldn't really raise an eyebrow at all. But siblings is another deal altogether.
Mm, absolutely. So there's plenty of scandal there in the book, in your account, to get your teeth into. It's really fascinating. But a constant feature that kind of is ever present in your book is Newstead Abbey, which many people will know as the poet's ancestral seat. Can you tell us about your research of the Abbey and how that evolved in this period as well?
Yes. So the Abbey, I mean, my story begins in 1720, really, and that's the marriage of the fourth Lord. He's this sort of aging old fellow whose heirs have all died, and he's looking for a young new wife to sort of revive his dynasty, which he does. And there obviously these set of siblings happen. His other project of this time was revitalizing the Abbey, and it was his absolute heart's project. You know, he was pouring money into making it this very elegant mansion, and it was very much admired, and especially for its artistic collection. It was full of absolute treasures. So the fourth Lord had built up, you know, they weren't wildly wealthy, but it was a very sort of elegant, up-and-coming, very much admired place. And then what really happens, so his son inherits in 1736, and then when he comes of age, I think it's 1743, all of a sudden he has control of this estate and the fortune, which when he inherits, even after he's paid for all of his siblings' education and paid for his father's funeral and all of this, in modern money, he has still cash assets of well over £1 million, plus all of his lands, all of the estate at Newstead, you know, plus the annual rents that are coming in every year. So he's very comfortable, the fifth Lord, when he first inherits. But what happens for his first 20 years, he rattles through this fortune with such enthusiasm that by the time he's in his 30s, the estate is in real trouble. Over the course of the fifth Lord's life, basically, Newstead Abbey itself goes from a very much admired, beautiful, entirely well-kept mansion to, by 1798, when the fifth Lord is in his 70s, he's sort of living in the bare bones of this abbey. That there has been, everything has been sold, the artistic collection is gone, a lot of the parts of the roofing are falling in. There are cattle staying in the sort of undercroft underneath because they're trying to keep them in from the cold, and getting a bit of money for storing hay in the Great Hall, all of this. So it's just a real downfall at this period. And it is really, it's because of this one person who's inherited and just is totally unable to control his spending.
Mm. So the young Byron, the poet, inherits when he's very young, and he's kind of, I guess, fair to say, captivated by this family history. And certainly it...
Oh, absolutely.
How much do you think it informs his own notorious behaviour? How much do you think he was influenced by these legends of his family past?
I think it's really important. I mean, one question that I've been asked a few times is how much does the poet inherit from, you know, his personality and all of this from his family? I think on a genetic side, there's reasonable evidence to suggest that the poet suffered from some sort of mental illness. So in his letters, he's often mentions these sort of suicidal thoughts, fears of going mad. You know, he could be very cruel to to people, to women especially, once they'd sort of fallen out of favour. And he has this real obsession with his weight as well. So he's, the poet has been retrospectively diagnosed with manic depression and with bipolar disorder, anorexia as well. And I'm not necessarily one for sort of definitive retrospective diagnosis, but I think there is something there. And the poet himself thought that the passions were inherited. He said, I can't remember who it was to now in a letter, but he says, it's ridiculous to say that we do not inherit our passions as well as the gout or any other disorder. So he thought himself that he got his melancholy and his sort of suicidal thoughts and tendencies from his mother's family, where they have their own very violent and depressive stories amongst them. And he implied often that he thought that his violent temper and risk of insanity came from the Byrons. So genetically, we know now that predisposition towards these sorts of things can be inherited. So it is quite tempting, and some recent articles have sort of pointed out specific figures in the family who introduced this bad blood, which doesn't convince me entirely, but I think that almost all of the surviving evidence for actual insanity in the family dates from the poet's time or after. I don't think there's anything sort of really convincing during the lifetimes of these 18th century figures themselves. But as you say, I think even more important than that, perhaps, is to remember that the poet was so fascinated by his ancestry. And when he came to Newstead Abbey when he was just 10, he was immediately captivated by it, just really enthralled by this history that he hadn't been confronted with before. And so he immediately, as a young boy, he populates the abbey with these ghosts of his valiant ancestors and all their amazing deeds, some of which came from history books, some of came from tales told by old servant at the abbey, but I think a lot of it was imagined as well. So he sort of immediately starts creating for himself these myths about his ancestors, and Newstead itself and his family history inspires some of his very earliest poetry, which is filled with ideas about how he will always carry his ancestors with him wherever he goes, with pride. So it's undoubtedly their escapades sort of undoubtedly influenced him in this way, though it is a bit difficult to disentangle, you know, what he's sort of absorbing and cultivating himself. So, for example, he said during his school life that he really associated violence and dueling with the Byron name, because he'd read about his great uncle's duel, or dispute, tavern dispute and murder trial. And so this sort of gave him a license to beat up kids in the schoolyard. You know, he sort of used that as a justification for sort of rowdy behaviour at school. And similarly, at the same time, I think he did genuinely wonder and fear that he was inheriting some tendency towards outright insanity. So he scares, again, school friends with tales of how his father had cut his own throat and that's how he died, which was totally false. But, you know, he liked telling these stories. So I think even if it wasn't genetic at all, his own understanding of himself and how he directed his behaviour towards others was definitely early on quite strongly coloured by what he'd learned about these ancestral characters, and probably gave him felt like he had a bit of license to act in this mad, bad, dangerous way as well.
That was Emily Brand. The Fall of the House of Byron, Scandal and Seduction in Georgian England, is out now, published by John Murray. Emily has also written a feature for our website, which you can find at historyextra.com/scandalous-Byrons. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Join us next on Sunday for a special episode where Peter Caddick Adams will be explaining everything you ever wanted to know but were too afraid to ask about D-Day.